my continuance as the federal co-chair won't help the agency in the long run. What actually will help is new blood.
The head of the Denali Commission is stepping down with no immediate replacement. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 17. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, sailings for a former state ferry come to an end.
She's going to go to a scrapyard and sold for demolition. So that's the end of the Taku.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
The top job at the federal agency tasked with coordinating the relocation of climate-threatened Alaska villages will soon be vacant. Joel Niemeyer will step down as federal co-chair of the Denali Commission when his term expires this Friday. The Trump administration has not yet named a replacement. As Rachel Waldholtz from Alaska's Energy Desk reports, the vacancy comes at a crucial moment for the agency.
The Denali Commission was established by Congress in 1998 to fund economic development and infrastructure in rural Alaska. But in 2015, President Barack Obama added another mission, assisting Alaska communities threatened by climate change, like Nutak, Shishmaref, and Kivalina. That has been a major focus for Joel Niemeyer. During his 8 years as the head of the agency, it's pivoted from funding new infrastructure to maintaining existing projects and trying to raise awareness of climate impacts. Niemeyer says it's been a sometimes lonely job.
Denali Commission has always been sort of the redheaded stepchild. Regional commissions, by their nature, are unusual. So we are sort of an island out there as an agency. And the biggest challenge will always be to get cabinet-level agencies to pay attention to what we identify are issues of the day.
One of the biggest issues of the day during Niemeyer's tenure has been the threat of coastal erosion, flooding, and deteriorating permafrost in Alaska villages. And he's waged a dogged effort to find more federal funding for those threats. In March, that work paid off. Congress doubled the Denali Commission's budget to $30 million. But now that the funding has finally arrived, Niemeyer's term is ending, and his exit leaves a big hole at the agency. Only the federal co-chair can sign off on spending, so Niemeyer and his staff have worked overtime to approve projects before his last day. Still, he says it's a good time to hand over the reins. The Trump administration has twice proposed eliminating the agency entirely. Niemeyer, who was appointed under Obama, is a Democrat. He says the agency needs a Republican head to make the case for it within a Republican administration.
Not everyone gets to cross the finish line, and I understand that. There may be some things that are bittersweet, but I know that my continuance as the federal co-chair won't help the agency in the long run. What actually will help is new blood.
Who that new blood will be remains an open question. The Alaska congressional delegation must nominate candidates for the Trump administration to appoint. A spokesperson for Senator Lisa Murkowski said the senator is currently vetting potential candidates, but no word yet on when a replacement might be announced. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
The Denali climbing season is underway. The National Park Service has already performed a rescue and noted a successful summit of North America's highest mountain. Rangers on Saturday rescued a climber who broke his leg in a 49-foot fall on West Cahiltna Peak. A ranger suspended from a short-haul rope below a high-altitude helicopter reached the climber in steep terrain at 9,600 feet. The successful summit occurred on April 3rd. Climbers from Wales and Australia were part of a four-person team that reached the summit. So far, 743 climbers have registered to climb Denali. The agency expects a typical season of about 1,200 climbers. National park entry fees, including at Alaska's Denali, are going up, but not as much as earlier proposed. Under a fall 2017 Interior Department proposal, the fees at Denali and 16 popular parks in the lower 48 would have jumped dramatically, increasing $20. But citing public opposition, Interior last week announced a more modest hike for all parks.
They took all the comments into consideration and opted to go with a $5 across-the-board fee increase.
Denali National Park spokeswoman Catherine Belcher says that means Denali's entrance fee will bump from $10 to $15 beginning in May of next year. Season passes will be $45. Individual parks retain 80% of entry fee money, and the increases at Denali are expected to generate an additional $1.1 million annually. Belcher says that will help address backlogged maintenance.
We can eliminate the deferred maintenance backlog for non-roads projects in 5 years with that additional funding.
Most of Denali's $54 million maintenance backlog is road-related and will take longer to chip away at. Belcher says 642,000 people visited Denali in 2017, a 10% increase over 2016, and the third straight year visitation went up. After a year of negotiations, Sitka Tribe of Alaska has entered into a partnership with the National Park Service, the first compacting agreement of its kind in U.S. history. Sitka Tribe would take over management of historical interpretation at the park. KCAW's Catherine Rose reports.
Sitka Tribe of Alaska is partnering with the National Park Service to manage most of the interpretation programs at Sitka National Historical Park. But Tribal Council Chairwoman Kathy Hope Erickson wonders if interpretation is the right word.
I've been joking with a lot of people about it. Why do we call it interpretation when we're telling our own story? And so I was talking with Lisa today, and we came up with the thought that we would like to have that unit named a Tlingit name, and we're going to consult with our cultural resources committee and see what we can come up with.
Lisa is Lisa Gassman, general manager with Sitka Tribe of Alaska. They're both visibly excited to be more involved with how Sitka's history is shared, especially in a place so important to Tlingit people. Sitka National Historical Park is home to the Tlingit Fort site Shishkanu and Battleground, where the Kiksadi Tlingit clashed with Russian-led forces in 1804. The park also maintains the Russian Bishop's House as a museum, one of the oldest remaining structures of Russian America. Erickson says the tribe would lead interpretation programs in that building as well.
Our tribal people have been a big part of not only the park, but also the Orthodox Church and life with the bishop. And so we'll be able to tell it from our perspective.
This compact agreement is historic, the first in the nation in which a tribe will lead interpretation and education services for a national park. It is also precedent-setting, though the mechanisms for tribal governments to pursue park management have been in place since the 1990s. Key to this collaboration is the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. Amended in 1994, the act now allows tribal governments to get involved with management of federal lands. If a tribe has a special historic or cultural relationship with a national park, they can pursue an annual funding agreement to run projects and programs in that park. Sitka Tribe of Alaska General Manager Lisa Gassman hopes STA's move to pursue an annual funding agreement will inspire other tribes to do the same.
I think there's been barriers. Kathy Hope mentioned there are maybe three throughout the nation that have been successful in this, Sitka tribes being, to our knowledge, the first that's program-based versus project-based. And we anticipate other tribes, though, seeing this success and wanting to start this in their area and their park as well.
Through their annual funding agreement, STA has filled some positions already. Former Deputy Director Tristan Gavon will lead operations through early next year, while Mark Sixby will serve as an education specialist. They've also hired one full-time park ranger and one seasonal park ranger. They're still looking to fill four seasonal ranger positions before training begins on April 23rd. The positions are open to all, though tribal citizens are preferred. And Gassman says the new rangers will have a new uniform, too.
And one of the things that might be a little bit different is there are going to be tribal uniforms versus the National Park Service uniforms.
It'll be a nice surprise, but one thing that for sure that will be on it is the tribal seal.
The funding agreement will need to be renewed. STA begins negotiations for that this month. Erickson and Gassman both hope for even more collaboration between the tribe and the park.
It's the beginning of a realization of a dream. I know I have some huge dreams in my head that I can't necessarily share yet, but keep your eyes open.
I think this is just one step in many that the tribe hopes to take, working with the Park Service and co-management of Totem Park.
But there is a waiting period before taking this first step. The annual funding agreement is being reviewed by Congress. Should no opposition arise within a 90-day period, it will take effect on May 7th of this year. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Petersburg School District is considering a new tool to ensure a dry prom.
Ultimately, you know, we want students to choose to enjoy school activities sober, of course.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers student and family education loans with interest rates lower than the federal plus, and they can be used at college and training programs in or outside of Alaska. Get more information at 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Tonight, the Matanuska-Susitna Borough Assembly will consider the contract for a timber sale near Trapper Creek. Contracts of this nature often pass through with little or no comment, but this time there has been considerable discussion due to the history of the lease site and the process by which the contract was made. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
The Cheejit Creek timber sale has a complicated history. At its next meeting, the Matanuska-Susitna Borough Assembly will decide whether to award another five-year contract for logging in the area to Charles Nash. He has held previous contracts on the same land, and a dispute between Nash and the borough ended up in a court settlement in 2008. The sale is off Oil Well Road in Trapper Creek. In total, 15,000 acres of trees are available for logging in the contract. The logs would be trucked down Oil Well and Petersville Roads before heading south to Port McKenzie and ultimately to China. Assemblymember Randall Kowalki, who says he's 100% in favor of the contract, believes the accompanying lease at the port will help shore up what have been shaky finances. It's estimated that Port McKenzie would bring in over $900,000 as a result of the contract.
Finally, the property taxpayers are going to have some relief from the borough's port rather than going the other way around.
Assemblymember Jim Sykes is opposed to the contract as is, particularly with the way the process is being done. He prefers the borough open up Cheejit Creek to the normal bidding process as opposed to a negotiated deal.
This contract, which since it's being proposed exclusively to one entity, sort of makes it look like a sweetheart deal.
Sykes contends that it would take the same amount of time to go through the normal bidding process that fulfilling the requirements of this contract will. Sykes is also not happy that the contract skirts the borough's resource management rules set out in code. He says this sets a precedent for not abiding by those rules in the future.
It really becomes the law. It throws out the code. And I don't think we should be doing that.
Randall Kowalki says this contract is not a sweetheart deal, and if it had been completed earlier, could have been handled administratively without the assembly taking a vote. That's because Charles Nash, until this past weekend, had an active timber sale contract for the area. Kowalki says while there have been no threats of legal action, opening the sale to bids now, after months of negotiation, could be inviting another lawsuit.
I would be seeking legal counsel if you courted me all the way up to the deadline and then told me, oh, okay, it's expired. We need to start over and you need to bid for this.
Randall Kowalki believes that possibility, along with the continued march of spruce beetles in the area, make logging the Cheejit Creek area a time-sensitive issue.
This area that we're involved in is kind of the epicenter of the spruce kill, and it's growing exponentially. Needs to be cleaned up. The birch in these forests are mature or over-mature.
Jim Sykes says the beetles are not a reason to rush ahead, citing a presentation made to the assembly by the Alaska Division of Forestry.
We should not cut beetle-infested trees from now through July, because cutting them now will only make them fly more than they would if we left them standing. So we have time to go through an entire bid process.
Randall Kowalki, Jim Sykes, and their five colleagues are scheduled to make a decision on the contract at Tuesday night's meeting at 6 p.m. in the Borough Assembly Chambers in Palmer. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
The former state ferry Taku is being scrapped. Jebel Al-Lau's Trading bought the 55-year-old ship earlier this year. The company sailed the Taku across the Pacific Ocean in hopes of finding a buyer who would keep it in service. But negotiations with interests in Singapore and Fiji didn't work out. Co-owner Ben Evans of New Zealand says it will end its sailing days in India later this month.
She's going to go to a scrapyard and sold for demolition. So that's the end of the Taku.
The state sold the ship in January for $170,000. Evans says it will be sold for around $1.5 million now, but sailing it 12,000 miles across the Pacific was expensive.
It cost us $55,000 to insure her for the voyage. My crew payroll was running at about $2,000 a day. The fuel bill was probably just under $400,000. There's some big figures there, you know.
State officials put the Taku up for sale a little more than a year ago. The original minimum bid was $1.5 million, but it took several tries to sell it, each with a lower price. The Taku has not been a working ferry for several years. Robert Venables heads up the state's Marine Transportation Advisory Board.
It's not surprising, but it does leave you with a bit of a tinge of sadness that she will no longer be in service.
Evan says most of the Taku will be recycled. Some parts, such as generators, will be sold whole. The cut-up hull will be made into rebar, often used to strengthen concrete in building construction. The Arctic is changing, and the people living there are trying to change with it. A recent conference in Nome brought leaders from Alaska Native communities to discuss the challenges together and opportunities facing an evolving Arctic. KNOM's Gabe Colombo reports.
Leaders of Alaska Native communities have very different ideas about where the Arctic is headed, but they generally agree on one thing.
We are now in the time where we are living two lives.
That's Don Long. He's a former mayor of Ukiagvik.
One trying to be a subsistence hunter and the other one trying to be working the 8-to-5 type of work that job requires today.
That tension was front and center at the Arctic Futures Conference at UAF Northwest Campus. About 50 people from the Bering Straits region and the Northwest Arctic and North Slope boroughs were in Nome for the two-day workshop. They compared scenarios for 20 years into the future based on different variables, including how much ship traffic increases and how much erosion worsens. On top of erosion, the land is also changing due to mining projects popping up throughout the Arctic. For some, it's a way to make a living. Here's Nome Elder Perry Mendenhall.
In my family, I have gold miners. They make a living. Gold mining just like other people. Even when they were told not to mine, they mine to feed their people.
Arlene Soxie is an elder from White Mountain. She's against mining.
It grieves me to see how disrupted our land is. All the digging that was done looks very ugly to me. There are areas where we used to go pick berries, but it's not available anymore because the land has been destroyed.
The ocean is in flux too. This winter saw the second lowest sea ice extent on record. Last year saw the lowest. Here's Nome Elder Charlie Brower.
Back in 1992, I used to feel comfortable going to Barrow by May the 10th to participate in whaling. The last few years, if I'm not there by the third week of April, I've missed most of the migration of the whale.
There are some upsides to more development in the Arctic, like better health care and fiber optic communications. Gordon Brower hopes to see more improvements like those. He's the director of planning and community services for the North Slope Borough.
With housing crisis because of lack of opportunity, it's like a cycle that we need to break with economics. Economic is the buzzword.
He sees responsible resource development in the Arctic as a way to break that cycle. And he wants to make protecting oil reserves in the Beaufort Sea a national security priority. Gullivan Elder Robert Keith says designing infrastructure around how nature behaves could help communities avoid the worst consequences and price tags of a changing climate. But he says that kind of knowledge only comes with years of experience living in the Arctic.
We've always been very adaptable people. We've had to live like that. That's part of our nature. we're going to survive, but I don't think that some of the places that we live at will.
For now, Nome will move forward with exploring a deep draft port that could bring more ship traffic through the Bering Strait. And down the coast, people like Robert Keith in flood-prone Gullivan will watch the sea ice retreat and the coast continue to erode. Reporting in Nome, I'm Gabe Colombo.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly decided on Monday to delay a plan to demolish the Mary Saya Recreation Center proposed by Mayor Carl Castle. Assembly members instead approved a measure that keeps the popular but aging rec center operating if it passes engineering tests. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The assembly picked up Monday where it left off Thursday after a marathon public hearing on Castle's proposed ordinance to demolish the Mary Saya Rec Center as part of a package of projects intended to help the borough begin to catch up on long-deferred facilities maintenance. Lance Roberts offered an amended version of the mayor's ordinance that would keep the rec center open and appropriate more than $682,000 to repair it.
I don't think taking down buildings that really don't have that long a lifespan in the overall scheme of things is the right way to go about it.
Roberts says his ordinance would keep Mary Saya open for a few years unless problems arose due to serious structural issues that borough staff and consultants have pointed out.
The assembly should definitely say at this point that we want to keep the Mary Saya open.
Roberts says he doesn't believe the borough should knock down the rec center until it has another facility to replace it. Castle has proposed a $35 million aquatic center that would be paid for with bonds. But Roberts says he's reluctant to go along with that because it would add to property taxes. He adds that borough voters may not approve the bond issue given the state's fiscal woes. And he says the solution is to cut services and keep the borough's budget lean.
We are going to need to dig deeper and do some more budget cutting, but everyone in this assembly knows I'm willing to help with that.
The assembly defeated Roberts' ordinance 7-1 with only him voting to support. The assembly then took up Castle's ordinance. The mayor told assembly members he hopes they'll place a bond measure on the fall local election ballot and that voters approve them, but he says he's not counting on that. He says he's proposed to close Mary Saya because the borough doesn't have enough money to repair, maintain, and operate it.
My point is, regardless of the vote up or down on the bond, the building still needs to come down ASAP or get multi-millions of dollars of repair work into it for the next several years.
Castle emphasized several times that his proposals are part of a carefully crafted 10-year plan to catch up on the borough's maintenance backlog. He said proposed amendments to his ordinance could disrupt that plan. He says he'd welcome suggestions on which other facilities the borough should close or demolish and how it could pay for that. After some more back and forth, Aaron Lajeski suggested Castle was just trying to stifle dissent to his plan.
It sounds like you're trying to find another way to close the Mary Saya if you don't get your way tonight.
Many of the 30 or so people who turned out for the meeting murmured their agreement with Lajeski's charge, but Castle, a former Borough Parks and Rec director, was clearly irritated.
It's ridiculous to say that I am trying to target this facility because I don't like it for some reason. That's insanity. This pains me. I'm very emotional about this. I love our parks and rec facilities.
Other assembly members, like Angela Major, also said they felt pressured by the mayor's pitch.
It just kind of seems like, well, we've already taken the money out of the operating budget for next year. And the more we talk about this, the more it's like you guys don't have any options other than this one.
The assembly finally approved an amendment proposed by Matt Cooper that would allow the $680,000 Castle proposed to use to demolish the rec center to instead be available for repair or maintenance. Cooper urged Castle to complete engineering tests on the structure as quickly as possible and send results back to the assembly. The assembly then approved a resolution supporting Castle's maintenance plan and his proposal to ask voters to approve selling bonds to raise $77 million to pay for it, including the Aquatic Center, to replace the Mary Saya and Hammy pools. Lajeski and Roberts both voted no on the measure. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Petersburg School District is considering using an alcohol detector at this year's high school prom to encourage students to stay sober. KFSK's Angela Denning reports from Petersburg.
Petersburg's homecoming dance was held in February at an off-campus community hall. It would have been a completely normal affair, except a few of the teenagers ended up in the emergency room after consuming a lot of alcohol. Rick Dormer is the high school principal.
I think some kids wanting to have a good time were trying to consume as much alcohol as possible before the dance, and that just got people in the hospital. And again, that's dangerous. That's not what we want.
Nothing like this had happened in the 9 years Dormer has been the school's principal, but once was enough. When trying to answer the question, what can you do to keep teens from secretly drinking before a school event, he discovered a device called a PAS, which some other schools use.
We just got ours in the mail today.
PAS stands for Passive Alcohol Sensor. It's a handheld electronic device that detects alcohol in the air. It doesn't require blowing into it, like a traditional breathalyzer. It measures the presence of alcohol as a positive or negative, but does not determine the level.
Looks like a flashlight. Students just walk in and they just speak their full name.
The PAS could then detect alcohol on their breath without any contact with the device. Dormer says the school is working with the local police department to get training and make sure they use the device legally. Back in February, after the homecoming dance, teachers talked to students about what had happened. Dormer also encouraged parents to talk to their children at home about it. And so did Superintendent Erica Klutpainter.
You know, it's an opportunity to learn. It's an opportunity to reinforce lessons with kids. It's an opportunity to have really good conversations at times when it's really fresh in kids' minds. It's real.
Besides educating students on the risks of alcohol, the PAS is another tool the school can use as a deterrent. Dormer says the goal is not to bust students.
It's all about safety. It is not about busting, and we're going to work with the police department, and we don't know what would happen if there is a positive. It could be anything as minimum as we're just going to inform your parents and get you home safe, and it could be having the police involved in that.
He says the school is still working out the details of the policies and procedures, but they would like to have the PAS working by prom on May 5th. They plan to talk to students and parents about it first. School Board President Mara Lutomsky says there are still details to work out, but she supports the effort.
Ultimately, you know, we want students to choose to enjoy school activities sober, of course, at all times. And we would hope that this device would act as a deterrent and the student would make a better choice before coming to a school activity.
Dormer says the alcohol sensor could also be used in the school to test things like suspicious bottles if needed. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Catherine Rose in Sitka, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Gabe Colombo in Nome, and Angela Denning in Petersburg. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Never miss another episode of your favorite PBS primetime programs thanks to Afternoon Tea on Alaska Public Media TV. Every weekday you can catch up on the drama of Masterpiece. Be amazed by our universe with Nature and Nova. Search for garage treasures on Antiques Roadshow and solve mysteries alongside our favorite detectives. Watch Afternoon Tea weekdays from 3 to 5 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.